and had recently undergone cardiac bypass surgery as well as a hip replacement. He was acutely aware of the quality of his life and worried more about debility from chemotherapy. One oncologist had told him that there was a 30% reduction in mortality if he took the chemotherapy. This sounded impressive to him, but I explained that his prognosis overall was very good, so that in 5 years, a 30% reduction in mortality might mean that out of 100 people, 10 who did not take chemotherapy would die, while 7, or 30% fewer, who took the chemotherapy would die. Presenting the data this way, in absolute numbers, 7 versus 10 out of 100 after 5 years, made it clear to him which course to take. No chemotherapy. Nimer treated George Franklin with high doses of cyclophosphamide. The T-cell lymphoma in his lymph nodes, spleen, and bone marrow melted away. Once the cancer was in remission, Nimer proceeded with bone marrow transplantation of Franklin's own stem cells. The disease disappeared for 6 years. During this time, Franklin continued his extensive travels, undertook some new business deals in Africa and Asia, and drew closer to his children. Then one day, drying himself off after a long swim, Franklin noticed a lump under his left armpit. The T-cell lymphoma had returned, but an extensive evaluation showed that it was confined to this area of his body. "There is no protocol, no roadmap about what to do at this point," Nimer explained. Of the scores of patients with Franklin's type of lymphoma who had not responded to ICE treatment, he was the only one who had survived more than a year. Each person's biology is different, both the biology of his tumor and his own innate biology, Nimer told Franklin. Nimer recommended radiation to the mass under his arm, followed by a short course of chemotherapy. The disease would probably return, he allowed, but this was the least toxic form of treatment, would eradicate the local recurrence, and, he hoped, remove a tumor that could seed other parts of Franklin's body. And indeed, that was the result. It was nearly 2 years before the lymphoma returned, this time in the marrow. "I have so much to live for," Franklin told Nimer. "Keep me alive." At moments like this, a patient grabs hold of a doctor's heart and twists it with his plea. "I try to respect a person's wishes as best I can," Nimer later told me. Given the severity of Franklin's situation and his desperate desire to live, Nimer recommended a second bone marrow transplant. Some doctors might argue that this was too extreme, the likelihood of success too remote, the chance of failure overwhelming. All of that is true, except that without risking failure, there was zero chance of success. Franklin's second transplant was much more difficult than the first, and he was in and out of Memorial Hospital with infections over several months. But eventually he recovered, and for nearly a year returned to his normal activities. Then the cancer seemed to explode in his body, growing in large masses in his abdomen. "I am not ready to die, Jerry," Franklin told me in a quavering voice, "and I think I am going to die. I don't want to die." It took nearly a month for Stephen Nimer to bring George Franklin to accept that everything that was humanly possible had been done. And now their joint effort should be devoted to giving him as much time as remained to be with his family and friends in comfort. Just because you can't treat someone any longer for his cancer doesn't mean that you stop treating him, Nimer told me. In fact, it is at this stage that treatment can be most challenging. How to balance therapy with medications to control pain without so narcotizing a person that he is unaware of his surroundings and unable to communicate with loved ones. How to give words of comfort while speaking the truth, acknowledging that while the end is approaching, the person can still make a difference in the lives of others. Many of the patients Nimer cares for face very small odds of remission and an even more remote chance of a cure. For example, he consults on the cases of many elderly people with acute leukemia, who usually fare poorly. The question is always whether to treat or not, Nimer told me, and I usually favor treatment. He elaborated. What I tell people, and what I believe, is that if you don't treat a person with acute leukemia, his white blood cell count goes down and he becomes infected, or his platelet count falls and he hemorrhages. If you don't treat, then there is no chance at all that the person can get better. He will be in the hospital anyway, so in my opinion it's worth giving it a try. If you do treat them, then after chemotherapy they have low white blood cell counts and are prone to infection and low platelets and prone to bleeding. But at least if you treat, then after a few weeks there is a chance they could get better and leave the hospital. If it works, then the person can have a nice year or more when he feels good, even if it's 15%, or in better cases 25%. And if it doesn't work, if the chemotherapy has no impact against the leukemia, then we can stop. Nimer uses more than numbers to explain his advice. He cited another issue. Patients and their families frequently become preoccupied with side effects when they are reluctant to undergo treatment. Oncologists have made considerable progress recently using antiemetics to control nausea and vomiting, so patients now generally do not suffer these side effects. That, in his mind, removes much of the toxicity that people might associate with chemotherapy. Nimer believes that doctors also overestimate side effects. He illustrated this point not with a dire disease like leukemia, but with osteoporosis. A family member of his, a woman in her 70s, whose bone density was at the lower limit of normal and who faced a high risk of getting fractures, had consulted an internist about treatment. The physician did not want to prescribe a bisphosphonate because of recent reports featured on the front pages of newspapers that the drug causes the jawbone to break down. Instead, he advised a vitamin D supplement, although she had a normal diet and good intake of both this vitamin and calcium. Nimer discussed the doctor's recommendations with the family member and favored a bisphosphonate. To validate his thinking, since bone metabolism is not his area, he spoke with Dr. John Bilezikian, a world expert in the field at New York Presbyterian Hospital. When the family member returned to her internist, the doctor said, "But you can get jaw problems. I told you some people who received the drug have had breakdown of the bone in the jaw." This frightened the woman, Nimer recounted. I told her that is a very low risk, maybe 1%, and usually after dental work. It is something to worry about in the far future. The urgent problem was to stabilize her bones and prevent a fracture from osteoporosis. She had been focused on a side effect by her doctor, and I understand why people do focus on side effects. But that distorts the risk-to-benefit ratio. The same, he said, holds true for chemotherapy. People worry a great deal about the risks of chemotherapy, but those risks, he asserts, are minor in comparison to the potential benefits against an aggressive malignancy. You have to deal with the problem at hand, he tells his patients. Most of the patients I have encountered who refused treatment do so because they are so focused on the downside, Nimer elaborated. They are only thinking about what's happening to them that day. This is an acute insight into certain patients' psychology, and also into the psychology of certain physicians. Nimer wants his patients to adopt a broad perspective, the long view, not a vision narrowed by fear. The real concern should be the underlying disease, but that is often displaced in the patient's mind by fear of the treatment. If you have multiple myeloma, and I suggest thalidomide, and you say you are worried about nerve damage, I reply, okay, if it occurs, then we'll stop the drug, but we need to combat the cancer. Paradoxically, people are more likely to worry about the well-defined side effects of a therapy than about the uncertain and seemingly boundless suffering from an illness. All of us, as James Locke, the cardiologist at Children's Hospital, pointed out earlier, instinctively latch on to certainty when faced with uncertainty. People come to me and say, "Dr. Nimer, I've read all about this chemotherapy, and I don't think I could ever tolerate it." And I say, "Maybe, but maybe you will tolerate it. So try it. And if it turns out you can't tolerate it, then we'll stop it." He continues, "If you do tolerate it, then we will continue it so long as it is tolerable, and so long as it's working." This approach, he says, takes care of most of the ethics of decision-making. It's a huge responsibility, Nimer said, of the ability to guide a patient and family to make a certain treatment choice. But you begin by finding out what the patient wants, and in order to do that, you have to know how to talk to the patient. Nimer said his role is actually to help the patient figure out what he really wants, and then to use the power of persuasion to show the patient the way there. Dr. Karen Delgado agreed. "This is what it really means for a person to be empowered when he is sick," she said. Most patients don't know what they really want when confronted with a crushing diagnosis and a confusing array of treatments. You have to show them a path that doesn't violate any principles of their life or their obligations to their family, Nimer said. Then you help them make decisions that are medically correct and have them feel good about the decisions. Nimer is acutely aware of how he talks with a patient, how he tries to draw out from the person the principles of his life and his family obligations. This kind of information cannot be captured in an algorithm, nor is it to be found in the alphabet soup of chemotherapy acronyms or in a quantified classification scheme. It transcends statistics and the latest research paper in the medical literature. As Nimer put it, their choice has to be consistent with their philosophy of living. He reminded me of a patient we both cared for years ago who asserted that quality of life had no significance to him. Only life itself mattered, however painful or difficult staying alive might be. He would not recoil from the most debilitating chemotherapy and radiation treatments. He had only one goal, he said, to be cured. Another patient we also shared in care with the same type of blood cancer ultimately decided that the cost was too great, the odds too long, and the suffering too extreme. He chose not to continue his treatment. In each case, Nimer worked with the patient to find the choice that made sense to him. While their diseases were biologically similar, their philosophies of life diverged. To further illustrate this point, Nimer told me about Vincent Rivera, a man in his 70s from Long Island whose wife had advanced multiple sclerosis and was in a wheelchair. Rivera was diagnosed by his hematologist with myelodysplasia, or MDS. Again, this is an abnormality of the bone marrow that hinders production of white blood cells, red blood cells, and platelets, causing anemia, susceptibility to infection, and bleeding. When Nimer saw Rivera, his white blood cell count was under 500 and his platelet count was 3,000, both severely low. His hematologist was transfusing him every week. Nimer reviewed the bone marrow biopsy and saw that Rivera was on the verge of transforming from MDS to florid acute leukemia. I talked to him about different intensive treatments, and he kept returning to the fact that he enjoyed going duck hunting on Long Island and that he was the one who cared for his wife at home. Rivera's implicit message was that Nimer should find a therapy that would keep him as an outpatient and allow him to continue to look after his wife. I told him about 5-azacitidine, Nimer recalled, a chemotherapy drug being tested for MDS that required a special release from the National Cancer Institute. "If you think that's best, then let's go ahead with that," Rivera said. But after several treatments with 5-azacitidine, there was no improvement in his blood cell counts, and his marrow still showed the brewing leukemia. Next, Nimer suggested antithymocyte globulin, or ATG, an antibody preparation that works in part by altering the immune system. ATG also proved ineffective. He kept telling me stories about his wife, what they talked about in the evenings, the movies they rented, Nimer said. When Nimer again raised the possibility of combination chemotherapy for the brewing leukemia, he could see the reluctance in Rivera's eyes. I kept thinking about what to do for him, he said, and I decided to try cyclosporin, even though the medical literature is lousy with respect to its effects in MDS. Cyclosporin could be administered to an outpatient. Within several weeks of treatment, Rivera's blood cell counts started to improve. His platelets rose to 30,000 and reached a peak of 80,000. His white blood cell count rose to over 1,000, and his anemia improved so much that he no longer needed transfusions. Mr. Rivera decided to sell his house on Long Island, Nimer told me, so he had enough money to move with his wife into an assisted living facility. For nearly 9 months, on a drug that had scant possibility of working in the long run, Vincent Rivera did not require admission to the hospital and felt good. During those 9 months, Nimer got repeated phone calls from his children. They kept pressing me to bring him into the hospital, to give him chemotherapy, knowing that his disease was transforming into acute leukemia. I explained that I had arrived at this path with their father, and that we were doing the best we could in terms of what made sense to him. Ultimately, the leukemia proliferated, and Rivera's platelets sharply fell. He died of an internal hemorrhage. I received the most beautiful letter from his children, Nimer told me. They finally understood why I didn't give intensive treatment in the hospital, that those 9 months meant so much to their parents. Dr. Jeffrey Tepler is a hematologist and oncologist in private practice at New York Presbyterian Hospital, his office a few blocks north of Dr. Nimer's. Tepler is a thin, compact man with a fringe of hair and a soft voice. After more than 2 decades of practicing hematology, oncology, he has seen hundreds, if not thousands, of people with maladies like breast cancer, lymphoma, and prostate cancer. As years pass, physicians derive gratification not only from the challenge of solving difficult cases, but also from trying to decipher the character of their patients. Tepler's interest in fully understanding his patients grew from his love of literature. Tepler counts among his favorite authors John Updike and John Cheever, Philip Roth and Saul Bellow, all of whom probe the conflicts and needs of modern-day men and women. Primarily what I love doing is doctoring and talking to patients, Tepler told me. I think the reason a doctor goes into oncology, or should go into oncology, is because he or she can form a special relationship with patients, a kind of relationship that is unique and not that common in other specialties, because of the nature of the diseases that we deal with. I don't want to sound corny, he said, but I feel this desperate urge to always do the right thing. People's lives are at stake. This did not strike me as trite, because I had referred Naomi Frelich, a retired scholar, to him. Years before, a hematologist had fixed the label of chronic lymphocytic leukemia onto Frelich's case, and this diagnosis was passed from specialist to specialist. No doctor looked critically at the clinical behavior of her blood disease or repeated the analysis of the abnormal cells in her circulation. Her family had called me when a hematologist in the city told them that Naomi would soon die, because all appropriate therapies for chronic lymphocytic leukemia had been exhausted. I suggested that she seek other opinions, with a specialist at Memorial Hospital and with Tepler. Both doctors discovered that the initial diagnosis was wrong. It was not this form of leukemia, but rather an unusual type of lymphoma that was readily improved with Rituxan, an antibody treatment that targets the malignant lymphocytes. Naomi told me she appreciated the consultation at Memorial Hospital, but felt more comfortable with Tepler's understated demeanor. He's very calm, not rushed in his work, she observed. She received Rituxan, lived for 2 years, and completed several major literary research projects. She then developed acute leukemia from the chemotherapy for the misdiagnosis years before and died. People with a sharp, aggressive side to their character gravitate to doctors who come on strong, believing that aggressive traits result in success. Tepler, as Naomi Frelick found, is soft-spoken and deliberate, so that kind of person is most likely to feel connected with him. For sure, surgeons and internists and others who commonly refer patients to me will send people who fit with my style and personality, Tepler said. I am referred people when a doctor thinks we will be simpatico. I had never thought much about the consequences of this aspect of medicine. A physician's demeanor and personality often mirror his type of thinking. So there is the potential for a self-fulfilling prophecy. Particular character types among patients will be channeled to similar character types among doctors. So certain modes of clinical thinking and clinical action will be applied to patients based on their character. As a general hematologist and oncologist, Jeffrey Tepler sees a broad mix of cases in the course of a day. This means that he must work hard to stay abreast of the trends and discoveries in a variety of different diseases. I really enjoy being that kind of doctor, Tepler said. At this stage of my career, I've seen so many different disorders, and I love to think broadly. Last summer, Tepler saw a patient who had been on vacation in Nantucket. She had fever, anemia, and an enlarged spleen. Many different diseases can cause this constellation of findings. The evaluation by the infectious disease specialist had included a search for babesiosis, a parasitic disease that comes from deer ticks and is clustered in coastal areas and offshore islands like Nantucket. The report from the laboratory said that thick and thin smears were done and they were negative for babesia, Tepler told me. But he takes nothing for granted. So he made his own smears in his office and looked at them under his own microscope. And there it was, one single babesia form on the smear. It was easy to see why it had been missed. I was so excited to find it. The patient was successfully treated and recovered fully. I always go back and read the recent literature with almost every patient who has a nuanced clinical case. A variation of a diagnosis, Tepler said. I try hard to stay on top of my game. So much of the joy is reading the medical literature and then judging what in a paper informs how you care for an individual. This joy often leads Tepler to linger in his office reading medical journals and textbooks well into the evening. It's hard to think deeply about patients at the moment when you are seeing them. You need some quiet time to reflect and formulate a cogent opinion. For that reason, he often tells patients that he wants to think more about their cases rather than immediately offering a treatment plan. He routinely leaves his office around 8:30 or 9 at night, devoting the end of the day to thinking. While I really love seeing people with these different types of problems, Tepler said, if I believe that the patient would be better served elsewhere, then I will send him to another doctor. This is another mark of a caring physician who, despite his expertise, knows his limits and wants to do what is best for his patients. Many of the patients referred to Tepler have very advanced cancer. Sometimes I think that one of the most important things I do for patients is to spare them the misery of futile treatment, he said. Occasionally, people with advanced cancers are flogged, a distasteful term used in clinical medicine to describe continued toxic therapy with no real point. There are some oncologists who seem to believe that it's wrong for someone to die without receiving every possible drug. Tepler is not one of them. People really wouldn't want to be treated this way if they truly understood what the likelihood of benefit was, he said. Patients do not always understand that, even when a caring doctor tries to explain it clearly. When patients want something that I feel is wrong, I am insistent, Tepler told me. I tell them that it's wrong. He refuses to humor someone if he thinks the request can cause serious harm. This issue often comes up in the context of a cancer that can be controlled reasonably well but cannot be eradicated, cannot be truly cured. Here, Tepler's interest in character comes into play. Patients want to be cured, and that's understandable, he said. But then some people demand extreme therapy, or combinations of chemotherapy, when a single agent is just as good and less toxic. He recalled Alex Wu, a designer who had stable metastases from colon cancer. The tumors hadn't grown for 3 years with the treatment Tepler was giving. But Alex just couldn't live with the knowledge that he was coexisting with his cancer. He wanted it gone, just gone from his life. But I could not tell him what I was really thinking, that pursuing more extreme therapy would likely hurt him. Wu left Tepler for another doctor. Another of Tepler's patients, Diane Waters, had breast cancer and a single metastasis to her liver. He had cared for her for more than 8 years. Diane's cancer exhibited the HER2 protein on its surface, so he was able to effectively control it using Herceptin, an antibody that targets the surface protein, in conjunction with various chemotherapy agents. She consulted many, many doctors in New York, he said, and then she found a radiologist at another center who told her that he could treat the metastasis in her liver through chemoembolization. The radiologist recommended delivering chemotherapy directly via a catheter into the tumor in her liver and said he would then try to choke off the blood supply. Chemoembolization. Tepler had advised against this, explaining that metastatic breast cancer is a systemic disease, that there were microscopic deposits beyond the single tumor in her liver. Moreover, she had no symptoms from her solitary metastasis. It was being well controlled by the treatment she was receiving. She almost died from the chemoembolization, Tepler told me. The left lobe of her liver completely broke down, and she accumulated liters of fluid in her chest. She was in the ICU for weeks. As he predicted, the disease returned in the liver. I am usually successful in convincing people, but in this instance I wasn't. But unlike Alex Wu, Diane Waters returned to him for care. I didn't make her feel bad about her decision, he said. To her, he said, you did what you thought you had to do, and you are lucky that you survived. Tepler worked with her on whatever new treatment was then most appropriate. Currently, her breast cancer is being well controlled with chemotherapy. Sometimes, catastrophic complications of desperate treatments, like the one Diane Waters received, lead to lawsuits. Looming behind every high-risk decision in today's medicine is the specter of litigation. Tepler has found himself in the uncomfortable position of disagreeing with a doctor who recommended an intervention because of concerns about lawsuits. He told me about Rachel Swanson, a middle-aged woman with ovarian cancer whose disease was clinically well controlled on chemotherapy. Her tumors were relatively small and had not grown significantly for a long time. During a yearly visit to her internist, she was referred to a gastroenterologist for a routine colonoscopy. The gastroenterologist noted a metastasis that had deposited on the surface of the colon. Rachel had no symptoms whatsoever from this, Tepler said. We usually don't perform colonoscopies on women with known metastatic ovarian cancer unless they have bleeding or some other problem. This was really an incidental finding. There was no reason to think, given that her tumor was well controlled, that it would perforate the bowel. Nonetheless, the gastroenterologist referred her to a surgeon who advised removing the metastasis and adjoining segment of colon. Once this recommendation was made, subsequent consultants were reluctant to challenge it, because, if on the off chance that in the future it did cause a problem, particularly perforation of the bowel, then they could be sued. I can understand their thinking, Tepler said, but you can't be guided by fear of lawsuits. You can't practice defensive medicine like this. particularly when it involves subjecting a woman to major surgery. Templer continued to advise Mrs. Swanson against the operation, but she was persuaded by the surgeon that it was important to remove the metastasis, even though she'd had no symptoms from it. Again, as Templer pointed out, it is very hard for people to live with the knowledge that tumors in their body could pose a future threat, despite the fact that those tumors are being controlled by chemotherapy. Rachel wanted the surgery, Templer said, and this was communicated to the doctors that she saw. In fact, one excellent gynecological surgeon saw her initially and told me that he agreed with me, that there was no real basis for an operation in her case, but then he changed his mind, probably to satisfy her want. Although the bowel was successfully removed with the metastasis, the surgeon noted several other tumors in the abdomen that could not be excised. Templer had explained to Mrs. Swanson that regular cycles of chemotherapy that were keeping her ovarian cancer in check would have to be delayed by the operation. And, alas, her disease just exploded, he said. She was in terrible pain from the bowel resection, and then the ovarian cancer started to spread aggressively. Rachel came back to me, and I felt awful for her, Templer said. And she said that she knew I must be angry, that I had told her not to do this. Yes, I said, I had disagreed, but I also pointed out, honestly, that no one can predict what is going to happen in any particular instance. This fundamental truth is too rarely expressed by doctors, and it shows Templer's humility. Although he has confidence in his own clinical judgment, he accepts that sometimes he may be wrong, or that he cannot definitively predict an outcome. In this case, Templer accepted that there were shades of gray. Mrs. Swanson could have had the tumor successfully removed without the postoperative complications and the explosion of growth in the other metastases. In fact, the resection would have proved to be prudent if, in the coming months, the tumor had perforated the bowel. The patient's choice, Templer told me, was in keeping with her character. She wanted to be proactive with her cancer. Understandably, people want the home run, he said. But often in oncology, what we achieve is less than that. And the risk is, by going for the home run, you can strike out. When Templer believes that any further chemotherapy is futile, he promises patients that he will be there for them until the end, and he further promises that they will be comfortable with the time they have left. When they press him for numbers, weeks or months, he gently invokes Stephen Jay Gould's remark, "The median is not the message." Many people seek out Memorial Sloan Kettering based on its well-deserved reputation as a preeminent center for cancer treatment. But often the doctor matters more than the hospital. A friend of mine, an artist in her 50s with bladder cancer who went to Memorial, saw this for herself. She'd had surgery there, and she adored her surgeon. Even after her metastases appeared and there was no reason for further surgery, he visited her in the hospital. She was not a celebrity, not wealthy, so there appeared to be no ulterior motive on his part. She was warm, outgoing, a sparkling person, and the doctor was showing how much he cared, how much he enjoyed her company and the company of her husband, a novelist, by visiting them. Her distress came from her interaction with her oncologist. He had treated her with what he said was the best protocol available. And when her cancer returned after a brief remission, his response to her queries about further treatment left her frightened and paralyzed. I spoke with the oncologist about her case. She has a projected 7-month survival, he said. There are no data that any other drugs have more than a 10% to 15% response rate, at best. I asked about several drugs in development. There are phase 2 studies, he said, referring to the second phase of evaluation, which is designed to assess the benefit in patients following the first phase, when toxicity is defined. I knew that several patients with bladder cancer had responded well to the drugs in these phase two studies. It's much too early to know whether those responses were meaningful, he said, and no one knows the optimal duration of therapy or the optimal dose. What the oncologist said to me was precisely what he had told the artist and her husband, in his flat, direct way. She should go home and live out her life. There are no data to support treating her at this point, he concluded. I am 56 years old, the artist told me. I am not ready to go home and die in 7 months. I have two sons and a husband I adore. She consulted an oncologist at another Manhattan hospital. He gave her one of the drugs that was still in phase two testing. She had a dramatic response and lived well for more than a year. When the cancer returned, causing a bowel obstruction, she decided that she was ready to die, that there was no real likelihood of sustaining her quality of life. She passed away at home with her family at her side. Fundamentally, it's not about the hospital, said Karen Delgado. Although there are those with better support services, better nursing, and more expertise in certain diseases. All of that matters. But what matters most is the doctor. And I tell people that a physician might be the right doctor for you, but not the right doctor for another individual. Delgado's words rang true. Before George Franklin met Stephen Nimer, he was treated by another specialist at Memorial Hospital. The two did not click. In fact, Franklin and his family took a deep dislike to the oncologist. But a journalist friend of mine, who also had an aggressive lymphoma, adored the specialist that Franklin could not abide. There are times I feel like strangling him, the journalist said. But that's part of why I like him so much. He is incredibly direct. He never pulls any punches. He tells me exactly what he is thinking and why. He can be infuriating, but he is a great doctor for me. A physician is definitely not great, however, if he abandons any person or family when things go sour clinically. Another friend of mine who worked in the intelligence services and was a heavy smoker developed widespread lung cancer in his early 60s. He had retired from the spy business, but prided himself on being an acute observer of people. Yet when he fell ill, he became blind to reading certain doctors' personalities. He was hell-bent on being cared for at Memorial Sloan Kettering, convinced that some magic there could reverse his dire disease. He finally secured an appointment with a young doctor on the staff, whom at first he found charming. But when the lung cancer grew after several cycles of intensive chemotherapy, the oncologist wouldn't return his calls. When he was admitted to the hospital with complications, the oncologist spent a few fleeting minutes at his bedside and then seemed to disappear entirely. His office said that he was traveling a lot. My friend was in the hospital for days without his oncologist visiting or even telephoning. He was emotionally devastated, afraid, and alone. My friend ultimately sought an outstanding oncologist in his hometown in New Jersey who was attentive and made sure that his final days were as comfortable as possible. My novelist friend theorized that the oncologist who treated his artist wife, but would not consider treatment beyond statistics and protocols, and the oncologist who abandoned the intelligence operative, both suffered from fear of failure and probably fear of death. I know it sounds strange, he said, supposing that an oncologist who sees so much death would flee from it. But I think posing as highly rational, acting only when all the numbers are in hand, is in fact an irrational way to care for people with cancer. You refuse to try anything creative, refuse to put yourself on the line. He must have known that we would leave him, that we would seek another doctor at this most difficult point in our lives when we were facing death. It is a more subtle form of abandonment than what happened to your friend with lung cancer. This is a fundamental schism in the field of oncology, between those who are driven almost entirely by data and those who are willing to treat patients outside of proven protocols. Sometimes veering too far from widely tested therapies can result in unnecessary toxicity and suffering. But I found a deep resonance in what the novelist said, that what appeared to be a rational form of thinking was actually irrational when applied to a patient's needs and goals, and might reflect the emotional state of the oncologist more than the clinical needs of the patient. Nimer and Tepler try to understand a patient's character and factor this understanding into their clinical judgments. My novelist friend showed me how patients and their families can understand their oncologist's character and weave that understanding into their decisions. People with cancer and other serious diseases can face a dizzying array of choices. Which path they take pivots on clinical facts and the dimension of character, their own and their doctor's. This applies not only to oncology, but to all of medicine, a mix of science and soul. Epilogue. A Patient's Questions. Let's imagine you are sitting in a doctor's office. For several weeks you've had a symptom that has not gone away. Say, discomfort in the center of your chest, beneath the breastbone. The doctor has taken the history, performed a physical examination, and ordered some tests. He reviews with you the information he has gathered, and believes that you have acid reflux, a common problem when the irritating juices from the stomach move up into the esophagus. In most cases, a physician arrives at the correct diagnosis and offers appropriate treatments, but not always. If, after a while, you are not getting better, the discomfort persists or has worsened, then it is time to rethink the diagnosis. Recall that most misguided care results from a cascade of cognitive errors. Different doctors have different styles of practice, different approaches to problems. But all of us are susceptible to the same mistakes in thinking. How to make the correct diagnosis? There is no single script that every doctor or patient should follow. But there are a series of touchstones that help correct errors in thinking. Doctor and patient will start again searching for clues to solve the problem. The first detour away from a correct diagnosis is often caused by miscommunication. So a thinking doctor returns to language. Tell me the story again as if I'd never heard it. What you felt. How it happened, when it happened. If he doesn't ask you to do this, then you can offer to retell your story. Telling the story afresh can help you recall a vital bit of information that you forgot. Telling the story again may help the physician register some clue that was, in fact, said the first time but was overlooked or thought unimportant. This will prompt him to look in new directions for answers. These days, when we are not getting better, most of us return to see the doctor with ideas about what might be wrong. Our notions sometimes come from knowing a friend or relative with a similar symptom, or ideas may have been sparked by looking on the Internet. Our thoughts about our unrelieved symptoms often focus on the worst-case scenario. Such self-diagnosis is a reality that neither patient nor physician should ignore. Since the doctor may not address it, you should. I'm most worried that what seemed like acid reflux could be the first sign of cancer, one patient might say. Or another might recount to the doctor how her friend was told she had indigestion, but it was actually a brewing heart attack. For some, articulating such fears is exceedingly difficult to do because of magical thinking, the notion that saying it might make it real. I recall one middle-aged woman with discomfort in the chest, whose face was a mask of worry when we were searching for a diagnosis. "Tell him what is really frightening you," her husband said with loving firmness. A relative had died of a pulmonary embolus, and she was terrified that this was the cause of her chest pain. After she told me, she admitted that she'd been scared to say it, since doing so might make it true. A thoughtful doctor listens closely to these worries. Alerted to your deepest concerns, he may be prompted to ask more probing questions, to have you describe your symptoms in greater detail. This expands the breadth of your dialogue with him and removes inhibitions that could hide clues. But the answer may not be revealed quickly by a fresh dialogue. The doctor may need to repeat your physical examination, focusing more intensively on one or another part of your body. Or he may begin to doubt the value of a particular laboratory test, or the reading of your X-ray. As we've seen throughout this book, physicians tend to go with their first impressions. The initial biases in a physician's thinking are often reinforced by his selective survey of diagnostic data. We all are inclined to seize on an apparently positive finding and ignore what may be negative and contradictory. Sometimes he may need to repeat laboratory tests and sophisticated scans. This can be costly. In the current environment of medical practice, repeating tests is strongly discouraged as not being cost-effective. The imperative from hospital and managed care administrators is to be economical. And arriving at the correct diagnosis may not require actually repeating tests, only doubting them. As we saw, there can be significant differences in how different radiologists read the same image, how different pathologists assess the same biopsy. Revisiting the diagnosis means the doctor returns with a sharp and discerning eye to inspect all the results to date, blood tests and X-rays and pathology reports. Yet there are times when repeating a test is essential. There are instances when the first CT scan was not correctly calibrated, as Dr. Herb Kressel recounted in the case of the woman with chest pain, believed to have a pulmonary embolus, but actually suffering from a tear in her aorta. There are times when the first biopsy misses the lesion. In my field of hematology, more than one bone marrow examination may be needed to find a malignancy like a lymphoma, because tumors are not uniformly present in the bones, and I may have placed the biopsy needle in an area of the marrow that did not contain the tumor. After review or repetition, the tests still may not give the answer. What else could it be is now the question you or your loved one should ask the physician. The cognitive mistakes that account for most misdiagnoses are not recognized by physicians. They largely reside below the level of conscious thinking. When you or your loved one asks simply, "What else could it be?" you help bring closer to the surface the reality of uncertainty in medicine. What else could it be is a key safeguard against these errors in thinking. Premature closure, framing effect, availability from recent experience, the bias that the hoofbeats are horses and not zebras. Each cognitive error constrains the pursuit of answers, and correcting the error helps the doctor think of a test or procedure that he didn't previously consider and can make the diagnosis. Is there anything that doesn't fit? May be your next question. This follow-up should further prompt the physician to pause and let his mind roam more broadly. He will begin to survey more of the clinical territory, aided by a vision that comes from doubt. Is there anything that doesn't fit? Was the question underpinning Rachel Stein's insistence that her infant daughter Shira's atypical case might not be atypical at all, but something altogether different. Is it possible I have more than one problem? We are taught in medical school and residency to be parsimonious in our thinking, to apply Occam's razor, to seek one answer to a patient's many complaints. Usually this turns out to be the correct approach. But again, not always. Posing this question is another safeguard against one of the most common cognitive traps that all physicians fall into. Search satisfaction. Your question about multiple causes for your problems should trigger the doctor to cast a wider net, to begin to ask questions that he didn't pose before, to order tests that might not have seemed necessary based on his initial impressions. You might have acid reflux, but also angina. Both are common. Or acid reflux and a tear in your aorta, a rarer condition. As we saw in the introduction, Dr. Myron Falchuk reframed Ann Dodge's case to encompass two pictures, and, by doing so, saved her life. Sometimes I come to the end of my thinking and am not sure what to do next. This may mean I made a cognitive error and don't realize it. In retrospect, analyzing my own misdiagnoses, sometimes I failed to ask the right questions, failed to find the abnormality during the physical examination, failed to identify a key bit of data because I didn't order the right tests. I had fallen unawares into a cognitive trap. At such times, ego can form another cognitive pitfall. I have learned to say to my patient, "I believe you when you say something is wrong, but I haven't figured it out. And since I can't figure out your problem," I continue, "I should send you elsewhere, to a physician with an independent mind who likes to tackle complicated cases." The internist caring for Ann Dodge didn't want to do this because she believed there was nothing new to find. She had exhausted all possibilities. If a loved one had not insisted, Ann Dodge would still be suffering, or worse. When a patient tells me, "I still don't feel good, I'm still having symptoms," I have learned to refrain from replying, "Nothing is wrong with you." The statement, "nothing is wrong with you," is dangerous on two accounts. First, it denies the fallibility of all physicians. Second, it splits the mind from the body. Because sometimes what is wrong is psychological, not physical. This conclusion, of course, should be reached only after a serious and prolonged search for a physical cause for the patient's complaint. The lingering stigma that exists in medicine and in the larger society about psychological distress and its ramifications through the body stands as a roadblock to relieving the pain and misery of so many patients. Many doctors, as we have seen, dislike patients whom they stereotype as neurotic and anxious. These patients pose one of the greatest challenges to even the most caring physicians. They may relate their story in a scattershot way, hypersensitive to every ache and pain, and make it difficult for the doctor to focus his mind so that he finds the tumor in the breast or the nodule in the thyroid gland. A patient's insight into his own thinking and emotional state can be enormously helpful to a physician. Recall how one of Karen Delgado's patients told her that she knew she was a little bit kooky, but that her complaints should not be ignored for this reason. Sometimes, of course, patients are not kooky, just terrified, but are labeled hypochondriacs by the doctor. A close friend in Los Angeles, a hard-driving businesswoman in the entertainment industry, repeatedly told her doctor about the aches in her breasts. Her mammogram was read by the radiologists as normal, and her persistent complaints were dismissed. She was told, "Nothing is wrong with you." Her aches, the doctor said, were caused by stress. Only after going to another doctor, who performed more tests, was the cancer identified. Her diagnosis was delayed by nearly 2 years, and the cancer was found in more than a dozen lymph nodes. We've all heard stories like this, and patients and physicians alike dread them. But if, in another woman's case, it turned out the discomfort in her breasts was not cancer, but the result of psychological distress, the statement, "nothing is wrong with you," would still be misguided. She should be reassured, and if her distress and symptoms continue, be referred to a psychologist or psychiatrist who can help her. When I was undergoing tests to diagnose the pain and swelling in my right hand, one of the surgeons sent me for a bone scan. This scan evaluates all of the bones in the body, not just those in the wrist. The radiologist who looked at the scan saw some spots over my ribs. The surgeon called me at home in the evening. I was alone. My family was away on a skiing trip. The surgeon said that there was no rush to operate on my hand because the spots on the scan looked like metastatic cancer in my ribs. I generally think of myself as reasonably well put together psychologically, but within moments my chest began to ache. When I touched my ribs, they hurt. As an oncologist, I know it is unlikely my bones would be riddled with tumors without any symptoms. But at that moment, I was suddenly not a doctor. I was completely a patient. My mind froze. I desperately tried reaching my wife. After several hours, I found her. Pam told me not to panic. She said I should go for further x-rays the next morning. Her words, that the radiologist might be wrong, did not hold sway. I spent a sleepless night, imagining a slow death from an incurable cancer. Despite all my training and experience, I was overcome by fear. The pain in my chest was real. I was first in line the next day and had a series of x-rays that showed my ribs were normal. A second radiologist looked at the bone scan and concluded that it had been overread, that there were no spots. It took several hours until the ache in my chest fully subsided and my ribs were no longer tender to my touch. I learned two lessons from this episode. First, after shocking news was delivered in a blunt and absolute way, I needed someone to guide me, to provide balance, to raise doubt, to highlight uncertainty, to think for me and with me. Because even though in another setting I would intellectually consider that the spots might be artifacts, I couldn't grasp it viscerally. Second, I experienced the power of the mind over the body, of psychosomatic symptoms. Of course, persistent but elusive symptoms sometimes are not psychosomatic, and finally a correct physical diagnosis is made. The doctor treats you, but you don't get better with the treatment. Before launching into a new therapy, the physician should talk with you and consider, as Dr. Judy Ann Bigby teaches, the context, where and how and when you are taking the therapy. Recall the study of 45 doctors in California caring for more than 900 patients. Two-thirds did not tell the patients either how long to take the new medicine or what its side effects could be. Nearly half failed to specify the dose of the drug and how often it should be taken. It is not enough to assume that a pharmacist or other health professional will fill in these gaps. There must be a clear mutual understanding between you and your doctor about the therapy, its rationale, and its specifics. Furthermore, as Bigby emphasizes, the doctor who pays attention to your social setting will think about the non-medical reasons the treatment seems to be failing. There can be other considerations as well. Karen Delgado told me that, although medicines are now color-coded, miscommunication can still occur. Delgado was concerned when an elderly female patient with an underactive thyroid was not responding to treatment. "Check the pills that the pharmacist gave you," Delgado said. "Are they purple?" The woman replied, "Yes, they're purple." For a while, Delgado couldn't figure out what was wrong, why the woman was still sluggish. Then she asked the woman to bring in all her medications. It turned out one pill containing 175 micrograms of thyroid hormone was one shade of purple, and another pill containing 75 micrograms was a slightly different shade of purple. The patient was in no position to distinguish between subtle shades of purple. In other instances, the treatment, although correctly prescribed and taken, simply doesn't work. Each of us is unique in our biology, and there can be important differences in both the side effects we suffer and the benefits we gain from the same medication. We can share a single illness, but not share its remedy, despite receiving the same drug or undergoing the same procedure. How long to persist with a treatment that has not quickly worked, and which treatment to choose as the second option, reflect the science and the art of medicine. Dr. Stephen Nimer immediately changed George Franklin's chemotherapy regimen, while other oncologists wanted to continue the protocol. Recognizing failure early and switching therapies extended Franklin's life by years. Good treatments are the products of a robust pharmaceutical industry, and many diseases that were once incurable have now been brought to heal with new medicines. But when a physician and patient make decisions about treatment, they should be mindful of the benefits and risks, the needs and goals they share. Their choices should be free of the influences of financial gain and the biases introduced by corporate marketing. All of this takes time, and time is the greatest luxury in today's medical care. Those who see medicine as a business rather than a calling push for care to be apportioned in fixed units and tout efficiency. A doctor's office is not an assembly line. Turning it into one is a sure way to blunt communication, foster mistakes, and rupture the partnership between patient and physician. A doctor can't think with one eye on the clock and another on the computer screen. But a thinking doctor does need to allot his time wisely. Problems that are well-defined and straightforward can be addressed with clarity in 15 or 20 minutes. And a patient and family can leave the visit feeling informed and satisfied. Complicated problems cannot be solved in a rush. The inescapable truth is that good thinking takes time. Working in haste and cutting corners are the quickest routes to cognitive errors. For 3 decades practicing as a physician, I looked to traditional sources to assist me in my thinking about my patients. Textbooks and medical journals, mentors and colleagues with deeper or more varied clinical experience, students and residents who posed challenging questions. But after writing this book, I realized that I can have another vital partner who helps improve my thinking, a partner who may, with a few pertinent and focused questions, protect me from the cascade of cognitive pitfalls that cause misguided care. That partner is present in the moment when flesh and blood decision-making occurs. That partner is my patient, or her family member, or friend, who seeks to know what is in my mind, how I am thinking. And by opening my mind, I can more clearly recognize its reach and its limits, its understanding of my patient's physical problems and emotional needs. There is no better way to care for those who need my caring. This concludes How Doctors Think.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.